What's up, guys? Kevin Estella here with Fieldcraft Survival. I want to recognize some of our sponsors that make this podcast you're about to hear possible. First one is Sig Sauer. Sig Sauer is the leading name in the United States when it comes to firearms and training. Solid folks at the Sig Sauer Academy. I don't think they get enough credit. These dudes are awesome. These gals are awesome because let's not forget Hannah Billadou, who's a total badass chica. She's over there along with all my good buddies from the Sig Sauer Academy. Guys, Sig makes some fantastic pistols. I've been playing around lately with the Sig M400 Tread, and that AR-15 platform, I mean, it's got great fit and finish, super accurate. I've let a bunch of students try it in courses. Very, very pleased with it, and I've never had an issue, knock on wood. The other gun that is one of my favorites that I travel with a lot is the Sig 365. The Sig 365 is a fantastic firearm in that it's a striker-fired pistol. That pistol is one that you can change into the small configuration or the large configuration, so the standard or the XL. You can go from a 10-round mag to a 15-round mag. You can do a lot with the 365 XL, and you can also put a weapon light on it, like the TLR 7 Sub, making it a great backwoods gun. So check that one out if you get a chance. And like I said, check out the Sig Sauer Academy. It's up in Epping, New Hampshire. If you go up there, stay at the Exeter Inn, eat at Goody Cole's, swing over to Kittery, go shopping over there. You can make a whole vacation out of going to the Sig Academy. And I'm excited to be up there this September. I'll be teaching Modern Survival Skills September 9th, which that class, as of this recording, is over halfway filled. And it will be a great time being up there for the first time as an instructor at the school where I train 20-something times. So really excited to be back up there. The other podcast sponsor I want to recognize is Vertex. Vertex has been in the game for a long time. I mean, I remember wearing Vertex pants at the Wilderness Learning Center in the early 2010s. And, you know, I still have Vertex pistol magazine pouches that I use when I go to the range just to keep all my stuff organized. And a bunch of the folks here carry various firearms in Vertex bags, which are designed to, you know, carry short-barreled rifles or pistol caliber carbines or pistols with suppressors on them. So guys, please check out vertex.com. They've got a whole line of clothing that, like I said, I've worn for many years. It's tough as nails. I still have a pair of Vertex pants that I wore on a pilot TV show that I was on back in like 2016, which, you know, required me to hike through the desert like 28 miles over 3 days. And I mean, I was dragging those pants over rocks and through briars and all sorts of crap. I still have pine sap in those pants from that trip. And yeah, they're lasting. So guys, check out Vertex when you get a chance. That's V-E-R-T-X. And see all the stuff that they have to offer. The last thing I'm gonna say is please check out the classes that we have coming up. We are training all across the country. I will be in New Hampshire. I'm going to be in Connecticut. I'm going to be back in Utah. I'll be all over. So if you're looking for survival training, check it out. You can see where I'm going to be. And of course, I'm based here in North Carolina at our fire base out here. So please check us out in Aberdeen. If you know anyone in the Fayetteville area, Charlotte, we're less than 2 hours away. So come and check us out. All right, guys, it is time to get to this podcast. So here we go. Hey guys, welcome to the Fieldcraft Survival Podcast. I'm your host, Kevin Estella. You know, I get this question a lot. When people ask me, they always say like, hey, if I can't train with Fieldcraft Survival, who can I train with? And, you know, I think the corporate response would be like, hey, you should only train with us. You know, you should be part of Fieldcraft or not at all. Like, but that's not me. That's not how I roll. I mean, my background is pretty diverse. On the shooting side, I learned from SIOC Tactical Group. I learned from Sig Sauer Academy. I learned from Gunsight Academy. I'm not going to say you can only train with Fieldcraft instructors. On the survival side, I've trained at the Maine Primitive Skills School, Jack Mountain Bushcraft, Marty Simon, you know, my late mentor. I'm going to tell you, you can learn from a lot of different people. So all the ones that I just previously mentioned, the guys from SE, the list goes on and on and on. The way I look at it is my competitors are the people that say, do not train, do not learn how to survive, do not learn how to be more self-reliant. Those are the real folks that are the threat to us. I want you to go out there and train and meet other instructors because it makes you a more well-rounded individual. Well, I got to say, I've never trained with this individual who's on the podcast with us now, but we have a very similar approach and we've chatted here and there over the years. And, you know, if you guys are a fan of the podcast, you know that I've had a few knife maker buddies on. I've had Ernest Emerson on. I've had Daniel Winkler on. This is another knife maker. But for all those that, you know, say, oh, he just podcast knife guys or whatever. Well, screw you guys. This guy is not just a knife maker. He actually has a really awesome background. Former U.S. Marine Corps Scout Sniper, former law enforcement. I mean, the dude's done a lot, and I'm really going to kind of dig into this and find out his background as a sniper, find out his background as the former chief instructor for the Cold Weather Survival School, and just go and go and go. He also isn't originally from the UP, but that's where he is now. He's a Uper. So if you guys are listening in from Michigan, he's not a troll. Guys, this is going to be a fun one. I want to introduce my buddy, Jerry Saunders. Jerry, how are you, dude?
I'm doing well. How are you, Kevin?
Not bad. Was that introduction sufficient? Was that okay with you?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. I appreciate not getting called a troll.
Yeah. So for anyone that's not familiar with this in Michigan, like there's the Mackinac or Mackinaw?
That's a point of contention. We might as well just call it the Mighty Mac.
Yeah, the Mighty Mac. All right.
Easy way.
So basically, like if you're from the Upper Peninsula, then you're a Uper. But if you're below the Mac, the Mighty Mac, you're a troll.
I have to put the disclaimer in there that up here, they will not allow you to use the term Uper unless you have a grandfather in the town cemetery.
Okay. Get this.
It can be an implant Uper.
Yeah.
I can never be a true Uper.
So I was up there in 2010 or 2011. I was visiting the Stewart family from Bark River Knife and Tool. And, you know, they're up in Escanaba. And I remember I was out there. And at the time, you know, I'm like 30 years old, 31 years old. And, you know, I'm having a few drinks with Mike Stewart, having a cigar. And I'm like, let's keep this party going. Let's go to the bar. And Mike Stewart looked at me straight face. And he goes, dude, you're not going to the bar up here. You will get into a fight. And I said, what do you mean? He goes, you're from out of town and that's how things are up here. Like they're bored. They just want to fight you. And I'm like, okay, I guess I'm staying here and I'm going to have another cigar. Like it's an amazing place up there. The woods are awesome. The bear population is incredible. The foliage is like I've never seen anywhere else. What brought you up there?
Well, you know, prior we lived in California for 7 years, and mm-hmm. I think about six of those years, we were constantly dealing with wildfire. I mean, it got to the normal point where I would get up in the morning, put on a hoodie, put on a M50 Avon gas mask, grab my leaf blower, go out and blow the ash off the front porch, blow off the vehicles, the roof, and go back inside, change the filter and the air purifiers. And that was pretty much life for 3-4 months out of the year. So that, and then being with the drought the way it was in California, we ended up deciding to kind of just throw a dart at the map, try to find some fresh water. And we became a climate change refugee, as they call it.
Hold on. Climate change refugee? Like, you know, were you living in the place in California where I think it was Big Bear, where they were getting that ridiculous snowfall this year?
I was living in Yosemite National Park.
Okay, gotcha.
Almost 6 years.
Damn.
So a little bit north of there, but kind of along the same altitude. But yeah, they did get massive amounts of snow this year. And now we are in wildfire conditions up here in the UP.
You just can't win. So let's kind of like just jump right into this. Obviously, like when I was, you know, talking to a buddy of mine who just bought a knife from you, he's like, dude, you got to talk to Jerry. And I don't want anyone to be confused. This is Jerry Saunders, not Jerry Young. We've got two Jerrys, I guess, that have been on the podcast. Well, this is the second. But Mike was like, hey, you got to talk to him because the dude's got the craziest background and you guys have to connect on about the cold weather stuff. Because Mike and I have had a bunch of cold weather camping experience, you know, working up in the northern part of New York. And he's like, dude, you gotta go hang out with him in the cold weather. I'm like, well, we'll get there. But let's get to that point by explaining life after high school or growing up. What led you into the Marine Corps, like your early life leading up to the Marine Corps?
I was always an outdoor kid. I hated being inside. You know, I got my first job at 14 working at a grocery store, and in 2 months I had already given them my resignation because I could do nothing but stand there and look out the window, and I wanted to be outside. So I ended up going down to a local plant nursery and just bugging them for 2 weeks. Every day I'd go in there and be like, do you want to hire anybody yet? And eventually they called me and they're like, hey, we need to hire you right now. So I jumped in the truck, I went there, and that allowed me to work outdoors, you know, not just beyond being an outdoorsman, you know, hunting and fishing and constantly being in the woods as a kid, but it allowed me to stay outdoors. So that in turn, you know, led into, like, I need to find an outdoor job. I can't stay indoors much. So, you know, the Marine Corps for me was a quick ticket out of town. And also a quick ticket to self-independence somewhat, mm-hmm. as I thought as a kid. And I wanted to grow up as fast as possible at that time. But that's what kind of led me down that path.
You know,
9 days after high school, I was standing on the yellow footprints.
No kidding. Damn. So in retrospect, do you wish that you didn't grow up so fast?
You know, I look back at everything in my life, and I don't think I would do it any other way. Here it's where I have looked back, and like, oh, I wish I could go back and do that. But I look at where I am now, and I wouldn't change a thing.
That's awesome. So you get into the Marines, and what's your first assignment, and how do you make your way up to the ranks of Scout Sniper?
Well, I got sold into Marine Corps Security Forces. And, you know, the recruiter told me, this is like Marine Corps SWAT team. I was like, and he showed me pictures of, like, dudes wearing black clothes, you know, rappelling out of helicopters with MP5s. You know, fast forward after boot camp and SOI, and I'm standing in the middle of Chesapeake, Virginia, at Marine Security Guard training, something like that. And then from there, I got split off. You either do PRP, Personal Reliability Program, so you guard nukes, or you go into Fleet Anti-Terrorism Security Team, which is more the SWAT side, kind of. So I got sucked up into Third Fast. And through that, man, I got more gun training than like a typical line infantry guy.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we were working right out there in Moyock, North Carolina, where Blackwater originally
started. Yeah, yeah.
So those guys were always on the compound. We were training to that same level as young shooters, which was, at that time, I did not appreciate it. I remember days where we complained we had so much ammo to shoot. There'd be pallets sitting there. We're like, we got to go through all of this. Those days are long gone. But so then I ended up stationed out in Norfolk, Virginia. And if you're not familiar with FAST, it's a anti-security element or an anti-terrorism security element, where their mission is, you know, if you're on call 72 hours anywhere in the world, you back up embassies, you're providing expeditionary security for U.S. assets.
Damn. So you're doing a lot of trigger time, and you're traveling around, and you're diversifying the skill set. At what point, do you make the decision, I need to take my accuracy to a new level. I need to do something more challenging, because there, arguably Scout Sniper program is one of the hardest in the military. How did you make that decision?
So it's a 2 year stint there. And while I was there, I went to designated marksman course, and we were using the M14, and it was cool and all. And by trade, I was a machine gunner actually.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd worked with the, you know, 240 Garof, Mark 19, M2 50 caliber. And I was a little guy. I think at that time I weighed 140.
Damn.
I'm running around with like a 75 pound machine gun on top of my pack. And
Jesus.
The amount of volume of fire, it didn't appeal to me. And then when I went through designated marksman course, I really enjoyed that. And I'd always been fascinated with snipers. Even as a kid, I used to tear up burlap sacks and lay in my backyard and shoot birds. I think it was a Benjamin Sheridan 22 caliber pellet rifle.
Mm-hmm.
I forget what they used to call those. The Blue Streak, I think they called it. Something like that. Great gun. But after I made it to the fleet, you know, your regular infantry line training, I hated the humdrum kind of mainstream lifestyle. And I look over here and I was like, well, these guys, they train harder. They're grunts still, but they're super grunts. They do everything better. And that was where I wanted to be. So it's a bit of a long process, but that's where we got.
And of that process, you know, talking to other guys who come from your trade craft, they say that one of the hardest aspects was the stalk. Is that something that you would concur with? I mean, would you say that there were other components that you're like, damn, that was the hardest part of the program? Or, you know, would you say that something else was the most challenging?
I didn't quite catch that. What was the question?
So I've talked to a bunch of guys and they're like, yeah, I washed out of the program because of the stalk. And then I came back and, you know, I did something a different way and I made it through this time. What was the hardest part of the program?
I think stalking was probably the hardest part. A lot of guys wash out for land nav. It was surprising how many people did not understand, you know, what an attack point was. They were still trying to dead reckon. And at that point in time, you have to move because there's miles in between your points.
Mm-hmm.
But when I got to stalking, it's a type of land nav because you're still taking, you're using your compass, but you're laying face down on the ground sometimes. But I think getting out there and learning, because you only have so many chances at it. And some guys just keep making the same mistakes over and over, or they make every mistake that there is to make and wash out. And the next time they come back, they've already made the mistakes. So then they don't have to worry about it again. But yeah, I definitely sweat at stalking. I think I got a 90%. But man, out of 91 days of training, it rained 80 something in Quantico, Virginia. It sucked.
Gear was never dry, huh?
No, we actually used I would steal these big patent, you know, air mover fans and close it in a closet of my ghillie suit at night.
Smart.
Air dry it that way because it's so fluffy. You can't throw it in a dryer.
That is so smart. So that took you all over. I mean, I was messing around looking at the recoil article and I mean, how many tours did you do as a scout sniper and where did you go?
I did three as a scout sniper. I did six total. Three as a sniper. We went to Iraq in 2007 to 2008 and then four. And then I did a MEU, which is a Marine Expeditionary Unit. So you get on ship and you train up to deploy to contingencies around the world. We went through the Suez Canal four or five times, doing security for the ships. And then, you know, trained in seven or eight countries with different snipers and different military units. And then we were home for 13 days and Haiti happened in 2010.
The earthquake.
So they made us pack everything back up. Yep. Pack everything back up. And then we lived on the beach in Haiti with no notice. We lived on the beach for almost 4 months.
Oh, my God.
It was awesome, except we could not go in the water because they had box jellyfish.
Oh, my God.
So there really was not great bathing. In a country like Haiti, it is not ideal.
When that earthquake happened, I remember seeing some of the news reports, and there's an island that the Royal Caribbean cruise ship line, they have called Labadee, right? And it's kind of strange because, you know, the rest of Haiti is the poorest nation on the planet. And then you've got this gorgeous oasis in the middle of nowhere that is all built up for cruise ship passengers that are super fat. Well, a guy from the knife community who we'll talk about offline, he did security down there. He was one of like the private security guys for Royal Caribbean. And he said that they were stationed in boats and they were stationed in the jungle because the mainlanders were trying to come over to this little island to steal beach chairs and beach umbrellas to rebuild whatever they could on the mainland. And when I heard that, I was blown away. And then you hear that like the jail collapses and all the convicts run out into the streets and a bunch of them attacked police officers and stole police officer uniforms. Like that to me is one of the craziest survival stories of the 20th century or 21st century. Like you have this island paradise that gets overrun by the Haitians, you know? I mean, what did you see over there that kind of surprised you or like kind of took your breath away?
When we were first assigned to go in, you know, we thought we were going to be doing humanitarian.
Mm-hmm.
Next thing you know, we're being assigned full combat loads, everything down to grenades. We're like, wow, we're going to go in and actually fuck these people up, huh? And they're, you know, we're getting reports that there's shootings here and there and they're attacking food distribution points. And at some point, somebody realized that you can't have American Marines down there just fucking people up at food points. It's not going to work. So we actually ended up working more with the villages, trying to push them up front and make them do their security, and then just kind of backing them up. But for 3 months, we ended up just loading our rucksacks with MREs, and we'd hike them up into the mountains. The country was poor before the earthquake.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't have anything before the earthquake. They lost a little bit more. And sadly, a lot of people used it to try to better their position.
Wow. That's wild.
Just trying to take more handouts. And also, Haiti is completely deforested. People don't understand that. So they have no wood to burn. There are a few banana trees that they plant and are highly, prized among the town. But there's no wood to burn. You could pay a kid $1 and he would get a slug out of the ocean for you. I don't know what kind of slug. Pile up trash and cook it on the trash. And then he'd give it to you for $1. And it was fair eating, but it was impressive to see that kind of survival skill.
There are stories of kids that live in trash yards, like junkyards all over the world. And they're incredibly resourceful repurposing. So they'll take like the humanitarian rice bags and they'll slice them and then turn them into rope. And then they'll turn those humanitarian rice bags into like plated women's bags, and they'll sell them. And it's like they're living in a junkyard for pennies a day, if that, and that's how they live. There's no leaving that area. And like, I think in America, we have an idea of poverty, right? Like we see people panhandling on the street. And then when you go to a place where there's extreme poverty, you say to yourself, man, those panhandlers have it good. And relatively speaking, granted they're living on the street, but compared to some of the other places in the world that, I've been to Haiti, I've been to South Africa, and I've seen some stuff, man. Like poverty sucks.
But even, and this is where I'm at more nowadays, even you look at those people, they seem to find happiness a lot easier than the people that are panhandling here.
Yeah, you think about it. Like we talk about third world problems, first world problems, rich people problems. Like, think about like when your kid or, the neighborhood kid is complaining. What are they complaining about? Oh, the Wi-Fi is down. Really? That's the extent of your problem? Like Wi-Fi? I think you're spot on with that one. Now, you go and you serve multiple tours overseas. At what point did you work on the cold weather survival program for the Marines? Because I think this is the most fascinating aspect of your story, and this is what I really wanted to talk about today. So how did you develop it, and what was the start state and the end state, and what separates what you guys do from, say, like the Air Force Survival Program and the Army program?
So kind of backtrack to 2007, I was working on the testing of the light strike vehicle. It was a hodgepodge vehicle that was designed to break down and go up inside the US or the MV-22 Osprey. And then, you know, I had to deploy within a minute. And part of that testing was we had to take it to, you know, different parts around the US. We had to do high altitude, cold weather stuff with it. And we went out to Bridgeport, California, right up there on the Sierra Crest. We were testing these vehicles, and that's where I learned all about the Marine Corps Mountain Warfare Training Center. They have multiple programs there, from horseback riding to animal packing to skiing, rock climbing, mountain survival. They have the high angle sniper course, mountain medicine, cold weather medicine, mountain communications. They have entire classes dedicated to field expedient antennas in the mountains. It's just a plethora of amazing knowledge, stuff that people join the Marine Corps to do that sometimes they never see. So while I was out there, I always swore that I would get back there. And I think it was 4 years later, after our tour in Afghanistan, a lot of things went south with the sniper community. There was a big, you know, that was a period of time where, you know, Marine snipers were pissing on the Taliban and NCIS was crawling up our ass for everything. Mm-hmm. So I put in for orders, and I'd been in Lejeune for 6 years at that point. So I didn't want to homestead, and I wanted to keep moving. Put in for orders and got sent out to Bridgeport, California to teach at the Mountain Scout Sniper Course, which is high angle, cross compartment, great, great shooting course. And when I got there, it's like, hey, you know, we get to teach the survival course and, you know, work on this, right? I'm like, well, we got rid of the survival course. And they're like, you know, we're in a war right now. Like, we don't have time for that. And it always kind of struck me, like, we don't have time for survival. Yeah. So it took probably another year of kind of begging and pleading and showing, because they taught elements of survival in the, they do the summer mountain leaders course, mm-hmm, and the winter mountain leaders course. And that's kind of for a squad leader, sort of a leadership, but yet, you know, you're putting that person as a mountain leader for their unit. So you're taking one guy saying, hey, you should be able to lead, you know, 30, 40 guys through the mountains. So they teach them some survival, but it was very little. So through that effort, and then a couple other guys like Mark Ambrosio and Matt Fechner, we brought it back, rewrote it, put it back in implementation, and it was going well. I don't know where it is now that I've left. I've heard they've canceled it once, and then I actually got hired to come back, teach for a while, instructors to try to bring it back. But I think they've since let it go again.
Now, Mark,
to answer your question.
Yeah. So
what makes it different between the services?
Mm-hmm.
I think it's more the environment. I wouldn't say it's any different than Air Force Cool School. I think the Air Force does survival a little better. And if I were to have left the Marine Corps and picked another job, I would have wanted to go be an Air Force SEER instructor. But at that time, they weren't taking E6s.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned Mark Ambrosio. He was the guy on Alone, right? Who?
Yes.
I'm trying to think. He got sick off of trout eggs, right?
He got... he had parasites around his heart, but trichinosis, I think, is what he got.
Damn. See, like when I saw that episode or when I watched that series, I was like, this guy's the one. He's going to take it all the way. And I was like rooting for this guy. And I saw like he was teaching high angle shooting at this place called like Branded Rock Canyon, which is like an epic training facility. I've always wanted to go there. And when I saw that, I was like, no, like I was so ticked off when he got that. You know, people are like, oh, you should go on a loan. You should go on a loan. And I'm like, I'm not going because $500,000 would be really nice, but I'm not risking my life with freaking parasites around my heart. You know, if I don't have to, you know what I mean? Like the juice isn't worth the squeeze.
So many of these people that are on the loan or naked and afraid. And they're like, yeah, I'm seriously fucked up for the rest of my life because I did this.
Yeah. And a lot of people don't realize that there's usually a stipulation in the contract. Cause I did a pilot show with the History Channel back in the day and they'll throw it at you at the very last second. And it will say like at any time, the producers can change the flow of the game. They can add in various nuances. So it's like, you know, many of the cast members on a loan, you know, they, I don't know if they can say it, but I've talked to someone, they're like, yeah, we had to use barbless hooks. It's like, damn, if you're surviving, you're not using barbless hooks. You're gaffing those fish and you're using treble hooks and you're letting these things swallow the hooks. But no, they weren't allowed to.
There's a whole unpublished rule book to that game that nobody talks about.
Ooh. Where does one find said rule book?
You just got to talk to them.
Yeah.
But like, you know, everybody has a geofence. You're not allowed to go beyond 5 miles. But even a lot of people are like, my geofence was a lot smaller than 5 miles.
Yeah.
You know, barbless hooks is one. They have to follow a lot of local game laws. So like, you know, certain mammals are off the trapping list. And mm-hmm. I know one was fox. They were not allowed to take fox. Because they actually filmed Mark doing a live release of one where it had got caught in a snare.
Oh my God. One of the guys who we've had on the podcast, he said that he was told in the very last couple of minutes, they're like, yeah, nothing with fur or feathers. And he's like, I'm out of the show. And they're like, no, we already put all this production value into blah, 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 blah. So I guess he was live catching birds and then he was recording himself like releasing doves or like these pigeons, you know? And, you know, it just, I don't know. I would never do one of those shows, but, I feel like we digressed a little bit. Would you ever go on?
I've considered it, but I don't. My goal is not, I mean, I think personally,
yeah,
it would be cool to see, you know, where that limit is. I've been out there for 13, 14 days, you know, with military trainings and stuff, but I don't, not for money.
Right.
The money has no effect in it for me. I think it's more about personal growth. And like when Mark got selected for that show, I was like, hey, you know, you really already kind of won because you know, nobody really sets up situations for you to go do this kind of thing with some sort of safety net. Somebody's monitoring you. So to me, it's kind of a win just getting to go on there.
Yeah, for certain, man.
But now, I do think we have missed huge opportunities to collect large amounts of data that we've just sold off for entertainment.
You're talking about like the like physical metrics?
Yes. Like the Marine Corps, we were starting to get big into testing that, you know, with cold weather medicine and high altitude, trying to get better understanding because, you know, they don't tell you that people with different psychological conditions can worsen at high altitudes. If you get a whole platoon of Marines out there and the stuff you see is horrific sometimes.
Yeah. Our
first hike at altitude, he didn't want to do it. So he pulled off his pack, sat down, pulled out his Leatherman and started cutting his wrist.
What?
Okay. Yeah. So we started finding out that, you know, different psychological conditions affect people different ways at altitude. We talk about going internal in cold weather.
Mm-hmm.
You're familiar with like cocooning or, you know, being internal.
Oh yeah.
It was common to find units that would come from Hawaii or Camp Lejeune and they would come up for cold weather training. These guys, they'd go fill a canteen cup of snow. This was almost, it was like some Lance Corporal Underground somewhere taught them to do this. Fill up their canteen cup with snow and put their finger in it until they got frostbite.
Oh my God.
Not only are they getting out of training, but they're now getting possibly medically retired for losing a finger.
Like, I've heard of filling up a canteen with snow or a canteen cup with snow and then putting it inside your jacket while you're working, right? And using it like a water generator to melt the snow, but never sedentary, never like put bare skin against snow to melt it. Like, that's just, that's foolish. But then again, I mean,
it on purpose though, to get out of training.
Oh, okay. Okay. That makes sense. Wow. Yeah. Cold weather has that effect on people. And, you know, I've stopped saying winter survival, like as much as I can. I catch myself whenever I can. I'm like, we need to start using the term cold weather instead of winter, because it almost lulls you into a false sense of security that the only time you're going to experience cold weather is in the winter. But there's some freaking cold days, late spring, you know, early fall, even middle of summer. So I try to get away from saying winter survival. I just say cold weather.
We had a high of 49 yesterday with rain because the wildfire smoke from Canada is blocking out the sun.
And we're oh, that's right.
Warm here.
So
it's just cold. We're getting cold smoke basically.
Oh my God. So you leave California because you're getting, you know, covered in ash and you move to the Upper Peninsula and the wildfire, which by the way, that smoke made it all the way down to New York City. And we saw a little bit of it down here in North Carolina, but nothing like the end of days looking apocalypse atmosphere that they had up in the city. Stuff was wild.
Yeah. I would like to see stats on crime right now, because I know that, you know, being overseas and being in sandstorms, a lot of criminal activity would go up during sandstorms and out in California. It's almost like being dark all day.
Mm-hmm.
So people aren't doing as much. They're a little more bored. They're a little more prone to wandering. But it'd be interesting to see, you know, how that's affecting New York City.
Yeah, man. Now, taking us back on track here for a second, one of the things that I think I've always appreciated about your work, and we've gone back and forth about a few different things, is we're very similarly mindset oriented when it comes to how we teach the survival skills. Like, you wouldn't classify yourself as just a primitive guy or just a modern, say, survival skills guy. You do a blend. And that's, I think, the way forward. I think that's the best approach for modern survival skills, is take the best from all the different kind of classifications of instructors that are out there. And, you know, you can teach a little bit of the bushcraft. You can teach a little bit of the stones and bones. You can show some of the cool modern gear. And I think it's that kind of blend that drove you to start your company teaching, but then also making knives, right?
Yes, sir. And recently I haven't been teaching as much, just a family dynamic. Like last year I got all custody of all three of my teenage boys. So a lot of my teaching has been going into developing them.
The most important teaching.
Over this last year. But yeah, like I'm one of those people that I have to find the most efficient way for me to do something. And then I've found, you know, whether it is primitive, modern, military, you know, pick your genre. I pull from all of those, but then I think what makes my teaching unique is I try to quantify that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, find ways to quantify those steps to where it's repeatable. Because if I can quantify it, then I can, you know, easily teach this somebody else to do. That's like bow and drill. A lot of times people will say, never gotten bow and drill. It's the hardest thing ever. I'm like, okay, let me talk you through the steps. And I give them exact measurements compared to their body, exact movements. And first, second try, they get it.
Yeah.
It's just, you know, being able to quantify. And I also use a method called EDIP. So you explain, demonstrate, imitate, and then you practice. And as long as you kind of follow that, that pattern for people, it's pretty easy.
You know, it's funny that you call it, you have a name for it, EDIP. I think that teaching formula is one that goes by many names, because I know when I pull people back, I'm like, all right, guys, bring it in. I do an explanation, explain the background of what I'm going to do. I always model, right? So I don't use the word demonstrate, but I use the word model. So I model what I'm going to do, and then I have them try it out. And then I always say, all right, guys, like, you got this one time. You don't go to the shooting range, hit the bullseye one time with your pistol, and then put the other 49 rounds back in the box and go home. I say, you need to practice. So it's very funny that you call it EDIP. I've never heard it referred to that, but that's exactly the same teaching formula I use with just different terms. It's funny how that works out. So you haven't been teaching as much, but you've been making blades. And
yes, sir.
What got you into the knife making business?
Well, I started making knives when I was 9 years old.
Mm-hmm.
I was in the library and I stumbled upon this book called Foxfire.
Foxfire series, yeah.
Right here, I always get it back. Foxfire, yeah. So in Foxfire number volume 4, and if people aren't familiar with Foxfire, it's actually a collection of articles by people from Appalachia, basically on Appalachia living way of life. Everything from hog skinning, folklore, you name it, it's in there. But there's an article in there on making knives. And at 9 years old, I started using a chisel to try to cold cut saw blades, make my own knives. Fast forward, military, law enforcement, firefighter, EMT, search and rescue. Always had a knife, different knives, lots of knives. And then in 2017, I really wasn't liking being the cop. It just wasn't. I thought, you get out of the Marine Corps, you become a cop. That's what people do, right? I did that. Didn't really like it. I found it kind of petty. After almost 12 years in the Marine Corps, I'm now arresting people for camping not in a campsite. Or it was dumb to me. I stopped working, and within, a couple weeks, I was like, hey, maybe I'll try to make a knife. And I ordered a couple bars of steel and made one. And somebody else saw it. They're like, oh, will you make me one? I was like, sure. So I made them one. And next thing I know, it just kept multiplying and multiplying. And that was, five years ago, 6 years ago. I think that was a couple thousand knives ago.
Wow. And now what?
Go ahead.
I was going to say, what's driving your design pattern? Like the form factor of your knives?
A lot of it. And I think I found it as a mental escape for a lot of it. Like, we don't talk about a lot of mental health and stuff like that, but for me, it became kind of my escape, because when you're working, especially when you're working with a grinder, you've got a 36 grit belt running 100 miles an hour in front of you. If you twist your knuckle the wrong way, it'll disappear pretty quickly. So for me, it was kind of became a healing point in my life. Because I think by 2017, I was pretty burnt out. I went from 6 deployments and then right into fire. And living and working in Yosemite, it's a beautiful place. But, they get 6 million visitors a year. And there's only about 50 people on staff that really are there to work emergencies. And you live there full time. So I was law enforcement, structure fire, EMT, and search and rescue, and the SWAT team. And then my wife was wildland fire also. So we constantly had radios on at our house. It was always somebody's emergency. I think we had an average of 33 deaths a year. All the climber falls, all that fun stuff. I mean, somebody's got to scrape them up. So after a while, it gets kind of old. And that became my escape, but then my escape was drawing from my experience also. So it kind of became this perfect blend of it started, I never said it would be artwork.
Mm-hmm.
Starting to become artwork to me, in a good way. If that makes any sense.
No, it does. I mean, I think there are, you know, my late mentor Marty used to say, some gear is for show, some gear is for go, right? Marty was an old infantry guy, EOD guy from Vietnam. And he used to say, like, oh, that's a really pretty knife, right? When guys would come through our survival classes. And, you know, our old survival school knife was the Bark River, Fox River. And granted, like Mike Stewart and the guys up there, they put a nice finish on their knives. You know, they buff them to a high satin. But Marty wouldn't hesitate to take his personal knife and, you know, go over and baton through something and then, you know, probe through the dirt for, you know, various tubers and then, you know, go to the kitchen, wipe it off and cut tomatoes. And people were like, you do that with your knife? And Marty would always say things like, if you're not willing to use your tools like this, you have a collector's piece. You know what I mean? Like you have something that you're going to hesitate to use as opposed to thinking of it like a, like what it should be. It's a tool. So I think that's something a lot of people will say, like, oh, you know, there are some handguns that are really pretty, you know, handguns that are aesthetically just pleasing. And then there are the ones that just work. I mean, there's a reason why I carry a Glock 19 every single day. You know, I need that thing to be reliable first. I don't care if people call it a big block or whatever. I shoot mine well, and I find it to be attractive in a functional way. So it seems like that's where you are right now, where you've got these knives that have been proven, but now you're adding in like the little details that people are asking for, like, hey, can you give it more of a primitive look? You know? And it's like, if it were more primitive, it would be a freaking rock, you know?
that jute wrap is, it's the bane of my existence.
Hard on the hands, right?
It's, you have to understand what it's for. And I think it is just as artistic as it is useful, but a lot of people want to grab that and say, I'm going to carve a Kupska with it. And you're, why would you do that? Use a carving knife.
Yeah.
But it is the knife that I reach for every day for cutting just about everything.
So I think one of the things that we got to talk about, before we wrap up, I mean, we've already been going for almost 45 minutes here, but, you had sent me a message when you found out that I moved to North Carolina, and you're like, oh yeah, you know, my family's got a lot of history there. So I know that there's a, like your last name is Saunders, and then there's a Sanders, and there's an issue over the U. So can you kind of explain, because your family's, that family homestead, or I don't know if it's a homestead or historic site, like there's a lot of freaking history only about 5 miles away from where the Fieldcraft North Carolina office is. So can you kind of explain that, like what you sent to me? Because I saw it, I looked at it quickly, and I'm like, we'll talk about this, but I want to just hear it right from you.
Yeah, so, and I haven't been back in a long time, so I got to preface with that. And I will tread lightly because this is a point of contention between a lot of people. But if you go to a Saunders-Sanders family reunion, you will meet a lot of Black people and a lot of white people, and they all know each other, and nobody can exactly decide on which side it was. But at one point, my great 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 grandfather, his last name was Freeman. So the best that they can do is, at that point, I believe that the name was either Saunders or Sanders. And then once a Black man married into the family, the U was either added or removed.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't say which, because it's made very unclear in the history records. But that cabin, man, I can't remember the name of it all of a sudden.
I'm looking at it right now. It's called the Shaw House.
Oh.
Because you sent me the link. It says the Britt Sanders Cabin.
Britt and Sanders.
Yeah.
And I think he married Spicy. Her actual name was Spicy Sanders. Okay. That was their actual cabin right there. And then they would swim in the creek. There's a big U in the creek right there, across the street from the cabin, I believe. It's still the same place we visited when I was a kid. But they would swim right there and across the creek. But just a lot of really neat history there. But yeah, that's why a lot of people will say, you know, I know a Sanders. And if I trace my genealogy, like even in my DNA, have you ever done the DNA thing?
I did when it wasn't linked to my name. I did the National Genographic Project, which it was all anonymous. But it brought it right back to Mallorca, Spain, which is where my great grandfather was from.
Yep. So we have a lot of sub-Saharan African
mm-hmm.
in our family. So it's mixed up all through. And it's very unclear, but it's almost when you go to a family reunion, you're looking at, you know, 500 people.
That's amazing.
And it's really cool to see. I think it's a neat thing. Some people are like, you know, they want to argue it, but I think it's cool that there's such a blend there. But it's almost indistinguishable.
Yeah, they say that you know that you're in redneck territory when you go to a family reunion to pick up dates. I don't think that's the case in North Carolina, maybe in parts of Appalachia, but you know, not North Carolina.
Yeah. North Carolina for me, I haven't been back in a while because it has grown so much. My town used to have a blinking stoplight there in Kernersville, North Carolina. And now it's, you know, 6 lanes. I have to call my folks and say, hey, where am I going? You know, just to get to their house now. Because that massive highway is cutting through there too.
Yeah, a lot of people moved south after COVID and during COVID. They're just like, we're getting out of these cities. I'm like, this is ridiculous. And, you know, the real estate housing market here is still okay. It's not as crazy as it was when I was out in Utah. But yeah, North Carolina is a good place to be. I'm enjoying it. And this history is wild. Like I have a little bit of free time later on. I might swing by the cabin and take some photos for you. I'll send it over and
That'd be cool.
Yeah, I'll find that creek too, and you know, maybe I'll find a cottonmouth in there or something to play with, you know.
I'm sure there's plenty of them there.
Yeah, there are. We were teaching a 2-day survival class recently, and this guy picks up his tent and he had a ground cloth underneath the tent, and he goes, oh, is this a black widow? So we went over there, we turned it over, and sure enough, there is that red hourglass. Like the South is no joke. Like there's a lot of snakes here. There's a lot of spiders. Like this place will mess you up.
Training down in Camp Lejeune, North Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
And we were, you know, always busting brush, and we'd be down near that brackish water, and you'd be dodging banana spiders, you know, the size of your hand. And then it'd get dark and you're still pushing on, and next thing you start hearing things slip into the water.
Oh jeez.
And it's the gators down there. And you're like, man, this place is nuts.
Yeah, who told me? They were like, God looked at the alligator 100 million years ago and was like, yeah, that thing's awesome. I'm done evolving it. You know what I mean? Like I'm done modifying this thing. It's a perfect killing machine. Like yeah. They're freaking dinosaurs. You know what I mean? Like the fact that they're roaming the United States, like the fact that we have dinosaurs roaming the United States blows my mind. Like I get it. Bears, yeah, they're furry. They like to sleep in the winter. And you know, in New England, the black bears were kind of like just big puppy dogs. They just wanted to eat food, sleep, be lazy, and you could scare them off. But like an alligator looks at you with just angst. Like it's like, I can eat you. I just need to find a way of dragging you in the water and doing my little spinny thing. Yeah, I don't mess with alligators, man.
Definitely commands respect. I remember as a kid, we used to do those boat rides in Florida. My family used to live down there, and I wouldn't do that now, I don't believe.
Yeah, there's some big gators and pythons.
Internet, the power of the internet, though, you know, kind of educated people on that.
Yeah, there's one of those first world problems we were talking about. So, hey, where can people find you? Where are they, what's next for you? Like, what's going to be on the radar? Like, where can people go to see all your stuff?
You can always find me at CorvusKT for knifeandtool.com or on Instagram, still at Corvus Survival. You know, up next right now, I'm finishing. I've got a whole custom batch of blades I'm finishing, but I've got the Sisu coming up. That's a smaller version of a Leku. It's going to be a full tang Leku, Terra Tough scales, a little bit larger. If you, most guys are familiar with a Puko by now, the Leku was the knife I trained with in Norway during their winter survival course. So it's kind of holds true to my heart. I like smaller knives, so that's really going to be my big thing this year. And then I'll be at the knife show in September in the Twin Cities in Minnesota, and then Greenside Training, Freddie Osuna, I'll be over there helping him teach his camo class in the fall.
That's another
really kind of the big things I have right now.
That's another name that I've heard bounced around. They're like, you got to meet up with Freddie Osuna. You got to meet up with him. And I'm like, yeah, I'll get out there. I know he and Dave Wenger did a knife collaboration together, and Wenger is a good friend from up your way. You guys have like a winter camp out too, right?
There's the winter camping symposium over there at Sturgeon Lake.
Do you know when that is this year?
I might try to make it. I don't, but you know, you know Jason from Lester River?
Oh, hell yeah, I know Jason. I know him well.
He's right up the road from that. He was the one that was actually trying to get me over to that.
And that's in October?
So I know he has the details.
I think it's October, November, right?
Yeah, it's cold here a lot of times. Yeah. So it's amazing.
Well, we're going to have to definitely meet up at some point up there. Help make my buddy Lieutenant Mike happy that I'm getting up there. I know he went up to that cold weather symposium, so you know, maybe I can convince him to take a ride. He's always good company. But dude, thanks so much for being on, and I really hope that you know, you have continued success and you enjoy the time up in the Upper Peninsula. And at some point, if you ever do make it down to North Carolina, you gotta come by here and you gotta try your survival brew, my survival brew, which our local bakery here, Lynette's, it's a Cuban bakery. They're making the coffee drink with 4 shots of espresso that's topped with Espumita and then drip coffee. And this stuff is like rocket fuel. So I got to buy you a coffee when you come down. Yeah, it's good. It's really good. But you got to have it in moderation because like you feel like you're going to have like a heart attack when you drink one. But in any case, when you get down here, we got to sync up. Well, hey, man, thanks so much for being on, and thank you guys for listening. This has been the Fieldcraft Survival Podcast.